It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is a two-state solution still possible? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. U.S.-sponsored peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians were thrown into uncertainty this past week when Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas signed documents to join 15 international agencies, a move aimed at gaining statehood outside of talks with Israel. This after the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu balked at releasing a fourth tranche of Palestinian prisoners. You may recall that at the start of the talks in July 2013, Israel agreed to release a total of 104 prisoners in four waves. In return, the Palestinians promised to not abandon the talks and to freeze efforts to push for statehood recognition within the United Nations. Well, Abbas's decision to join the agencies, which include the Geneva and Vienna Conventions, but notably not the International Court of Justice, appear to scuttle a deal floated by U.S. officials to extend the April 29th deadline to reach an agreement on a framework for an eventual peace deal. Under that proposed deal, the United States would release Jonathan Pollard, jailed for nearly three decades in the United States, for spying on behalf of Israel. In addition, Israel would free a large tranche of Palestinian prisoners and show restraint in its building of settlements on disputed territory. Well, in response to Abbas's move vis-a-vis the UN agencies, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who has made the talks something of a personal mission, canceled a scheduled meeting with him and a trip to the region. In addition to Israel's cancellation of a Palestinian prisoner release and the PA's pursuit of further recognition by the United Nations, the talks have been endangered by ongoing Israeli settlement building in the West Bank. Nonetheless, Secretary of State Kerry insisted that neither side has indicated it is ready to quit the talks, but he said the effort cannot be open-ended and warned that there is a limit to the U.S. role if both sides are not willing to take steps for peace. Kerry has spent the past few weeks trying to keep the negotiations going as the process closes in on the end of the initial nine-month period that Israeli and Palestinians agreed to last year. Efforts to forge a lasting peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians is a centerpiece of the Obama administration's foreign policy. For more on prospects of salvaging the peace talks and the two-state solution in general, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Reith Alomari is executive director at the American Task Force on Palestine, that's a nonprofit organization based in Washington dedicated to a two-state solution. Prior to that, Reith served in various positions within the Palestinian Authority, including as director of the International Relations Department in the Office of the Palestinian President. And Nathan Gutman, he is Washington bureau chief for the Jewish Daily Forward. Before joining the Forward, Nathan served as Washington correspondent for the Israeli dailies Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
And before we talk, even, I want to just mention, of course, that Reith is Palestinian and Nathan happens to be Israeli. And I would venture to say you may agree more than you disagree on things, but I do want you to bring out the points of view of your various countrymen. Well, first to you, Reith Alomari. So after laborious efforts, U.S.-sponsored peace talks, they seem to have hit an impasse with the Palestinians seeking recognition from international agencies and, of course, Israel declining to release Palestinian prisoners. Let's step back. Why do you think Israel reneged on the release of this last tranche of Palestinian prisoners that seemed to spark this current impasse?
As Palestinians see it, this continues in a trend of Israeli behavior where you agree on something and then you renegotiate it, you get the price once and you want to get a second price for it. So from the Palestinians' perspective, this was seen as an Israeli attempt to scuttle the talks and to even humiliate the Palestinians. It was not only the refusal to release the prisoners, but also the announcement of 700 settlement units in a suburb of Jerusalem, in a settlement in Jerusalem. And so all of these things together showed the Palestinians that the Israelis were not serious about moving forward and forced Abbas in some ways to have to take countermeasures to maintain some semblance of credibility to his own population and to his own constituency.
Turning to you, Nathan Gutman, how do you see this Israeli reluctance at releasing this last tranche of prisoners. Do you see it as some sort of a way to humiliate the Palestinians, as Gaith has communicated? How do you see it?
I think the perception of the Israeli government was that this final wave of Palestinian prisoner release, which included also Israeli Arabs, Palestinians that are citizens of Israel, which is a touchier issue for Israel, this is something that came with a certain political price for President Benjamin Netanyahu. The right wing within his government opposed it. And there was this feeling that if you go ahead with this final release of prisoners, but there is no promise for the continuation of the negotiations once the time lapses next month, there was no sense in actually going forward with this bold move that would cost him politically without any promise for future negotiations or something coming out of this process. So the political calculation on the Israeli side was, well, it doesn't make any sense to make this gesture right now when it won't lead to any results on the ground.
Gaith Alomari, just a quick response on that. Can you see the logic in the Israelis' reluctance on this point and the timing?
When the Israeli government agreed to the four tranches of release of prisoners, they knew already that this is going to happen a month before the end of the talks. The Palestinians have already paid the price for that by halting their approach to the United Nations. So from that perspective, the Palestinians shouldn't be paying the price for Israeli domestic political concerns. This is an Israeli obligation, and they were expected to meet it.
How do you see it, Nathan, this type of explanation?
For sure, it makes sense. Just again, to explain the Israeli rationale of this, and of course, there was an agreement with the Americans and with the Palestinians when the process started to release prisoners in these four tranches. However, if you reach the end of the process and it doesn't seem to be leading to any agreement, and it doesn't seem to be even leading to any extension of the talks in order to reach some kind of an agreement in 6 months or a year from now, it just didn't make political sense for Israelis. And that would be their overwhelming argument for doing so.
Let's move on to how the Palestinians reacted by seeking recognition for over a dozen UN agencies, Gaith Alomari. Was this, in fact, a retaliation for this reluctance on the part of Israelis for releasing the prisoners? What's going on?
First of all, to be technical about it, the Palestinians very carefully calibrated their move, and they're actually not joining international agencies. They have signed international conventions which are not attached to agencies. And the reason they did this is because if they joined an agency, this would trigger an American law defunding the UN agencies. And the Palestinians were very careful not to do it because they did not want to go on a head-on collision with the United States. Now, the reason they did it, partly to raise the temperature, partly to show the Israelis that there is a price to be done, it's a shot across the bow, as it were, but also for domestic political reasons, because Abbas felt at that moment he's already under attack from Hamas, from members within his own Fatah party, and he wanted to show that he is not someone who would just lie down and take the blows, but he has something to dish back. So it's a bit of diplomacy and brinksmanship, and frankly quite risky brinksmanship, but also a big dose of domestic political management.
So Nathan Gutman, with regard to this attempt, as Gaith Alomari said, to sign on to not actually join these international agencies, which the Palestinians agreed not to do, but which they did, presumably in retaliation for the Israeli lack of releasing prisoners. How do the Israelis see this? Do they understand that it's probably more of a tactic rather than anything lasting? How is it perceived?
I think on a certain level, Israeli leadership understands that this is part of a tactic on both sides in trying to position themselves for the next round, and there are consequences for actions. But on the grassroots level, Israelis have this real concern about what Israel terms as lawfare, as going to international bodies in order to counter the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. And these treaties, even though they have probably nothing to do directly with the statehood, are seen as another step towards this unilateral attempt to achieve legal status for the Palestinian Authority. And that is something Israel is concerned from. The concern in Israel shifted in a certain way from the military side, from the fear of another intifada, into the fear of Palestinians taking their own steps with international backing and gaining recognition as a state without negotiating it with Israel.
Well, just a devil's advocate question. Do you think had the Israelis released this tranche of prisoners, presumably this act vis-a-vis the international agencies would not have occurred?
Right, of course. However, we would have to ask what would happen the next day. I mean, if there is no agreement, so what would happen? The time would expire, the 9 months that Secretary Kerry gave this process would run out, and then the Palestinians would still be free to go to any international body and ask for recognition. So it's just a matter of a month either way.
Well, speaking of recognition, back to you, Gaith El-Omari, there's another issue, which is Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's insistence that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Now, I assume this is still on the table. Why do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu insists on this particular point?
I cannot really speak for Netanyahu. I assume he is doing it for a number of reasons, partly because this is something that touches a very core concern of the Israelis, a gut concern about being recognized in the region, or at least the way it is seen. Let me put it this way. The way it is seen by the Palestinian negotiators is introducing another element to the negotiations, asking the Palestinians to give up on their national narrative in favor of the Israeli narrative. And they saw this as throwing some spanner in the works, as it were, to scuttle the peace process. Now, whether it is genuine or whether it's tactical, reality is this is now an important issue, but this is not an issue, in many people's view, including mine, to be addressed at this stage of the negotiations. If it's going to be addressed, it should be addressed when we go more in depth into the substance of the negotiations. Keep in mind, so far, the negotiations have really been mainly about process, less about substance.
Turning to you, Natan Gutman, again, what is the motive behind Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insisting on this particular point that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state? Because one could argue that that would be implicit in the official recognition of Israel, since it is a homeland for Jews. Every Jew is able to emigrate to Israel. That wouldn't undermine that particular notion. And in addition, Israel is home to 20% Arabs. So what is really behind this demand by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, you could say that, I mean, Israel does need the recognition of Mahmoud Abbas in that it is a Jewish state. Israel is a Jewish state by its own declaration of independence that defines it as a Jewish and democratic state. So why the Israeli insistence? And some would say it's just a cynical move to introduce another problem in the negotiations, to push the deadline further on, not to make tough decisions. But it does also touch on a deep Israeli sentiment, which is this concern that, say we reach an agreement, the West Bank or most of it becomes Palestinian state, Israel retreats to the Green Line and becomes a Jewish democratic state. What about the right of return of Palestinians? What about this understanding that this agreement is the end of the road, that Palestinians have settled their demands, Israelis can live in peace? I guess when by insisting that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state, the Israelis are actually saying, we want to know that once we sign an agreement and you have your state, that is the end of claims. That is not a beginning of another discussion over what happens in Israel proper.
Quick follow-up. What about Gaith's suggestion that this could be indeed a legitimate point, but something that belongs at a later stage in the negotiations?
Well, of course, why you raise this issue right now? Netanyahu will tell you, well, because we're reaching the point in which we have to make tough decisions and we have to know that this is on the table. Others will say it's just a way of pushing the decision further down the road.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Gaith El-Omari, he's executive director at the American Task Force on Palestine, and Natan Gutman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Jewish Daily Forward, from whom you just heard. We are talking about diplomatic attempts to salvage peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. And as always, we love to hear from you. So please send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Thomas Nebi of Lagos, Nigeria. Back to you, Gaith El-Omari. There's another element here that was introduced recently regarding Jonathan Pollard. Now, Jonathan Pollard was convicted of espionage against the United States. Successive Israeli governments have asked the United States for an early release. He was convicted back in 1987. For passing secrets to Israel, and of course he has been sentenced to life. Of course, the idea that if he was released, Israel might be more inclined to release this last batch of prisoners, which might break the impasse. Where does this particular diplomatic offer stand?
Right now, it stands nowhere. Right now, we're at a point where we're just trying to revive the negotiations and all of the old ideas that we have heard, whether it is framework agreement, whether it is a new package, are at the moment off the table. Now, they might be reintroduced in the near future, but they're off the table right now. But it's interesting with Pollard. From a Palestinian point of view, at the end of the day, Pollard is none of the Palestinians' concern. It is a bilateral Israeli-American issue. But what was very interesting, if you observe the reaction in Washington and the United States, almost, with notable exceptions, almost wall-to-wall rejection or opposition to this idea.
Very interesting. Well, back to you, Nathan Gutman. Since it is more or less a U.S.-Israeli bilateral issue, and the idea is that releasing Pollard might soften the Israelis, perhaps induce them to be more flexible on the Palestinian prisoner release in order to revive the negotiations again, what is behind this, and is this a viable option?
It's an interesting move in terms of politics. Of course, Jonathan Pollard has nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He spied many years ago on issues relating to national security. It really has nothing to do with this specific case. But using him as a sweetener could be productive in a certain way. There are those who will say that he's a valuable bargaining chip and Secretary Kerry maybe pulled it out too early in the game for not getting as much in return as he could have when there is a real deal on the table. But for Israelis, I think because the issue of Jonathan Pollard became so important, because so much exaggerated attention to the plight of Jonathan Pollard and the fact that he is sitting in prison for almost 30 years, while other spies that have done less damage than he did are already released. There is a sense that Israelis really want to see Jonathan Pollard out of prison. And if Netanyahu could come to the Israeli public in the eve of Passover and say, look, I'm bringing home Jonathan Pollard, the other issue of I'm also releasing Palestinian terrorists and other Arab Israelis that are in prison may have been forgotten, and maybe it would be easier for him politically to sell the deal to Israelis.
Well, as Gaith said, notwithstanding opposition, even within Jewish circles here in the United States, that is opposition to his early release, we shall see where this is going in the coming days and weeks. Well, back to you, Gaith Al-Omari. Let's get underneath the problems. Let's take a look at the real impediments. We're talking sort of, you know, tit for tat and the negotiations, the process, but underneath it all, there are real domestic political considerations on both the Israeli and Palestinian side. This is such a long-standing conflict that would do well to be solved, not only for the Palestinians and Israelis, but for the entire neighborhood, region, and the world. What are the major impediments to a deal, in your view, on both sides?
I would say there are two different issues to deal with. The first one is the issues on substance, what we are negotiating, the content of a deal. And on that one, I must say there has been interesting and significant progress over the last 9 months. It's not out there in the public because this has been a very tightly controlled process in terms of messaging. But the indication we have is that there is progress. Yet there are, of course, very important issues remaining: refugees, the security in the Jordan River, the issue of recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. So that's one part of the impediments. But the other one is one that you referred to, which is the issue of domestic politics right now. Right now, I mean, Natan can speak more about the Israelis, but it's enough to say that they have a very shaky coalition if something like this is to be done. And for Abbas, he is facing opposition from three main directions. The Hamas movement that will be opposed to him no matter what. Opposition within Fatah itself, crystallizing again around one individual called Mohammed Dahlan, and it's come out to the public. And thirdly, the fact that Abbas's term as president has expired a few years ago and there's no election in the offing, which throws some questions about the legitimacy and credibility of the leadership. So this makes him in a politically weak position and maybe might make some of the concessions on substance or process more difficult for him.
Turning to you, Nathan Gutman, for your take on what are the major impediments, notwithstanding some of the issues we just discussed, and also the domestic politics on the Israeli side?
Of course, there are all the real issues that Raith mentioned regarding what are the contours of the final agreement. Although most people agree that these things can be settled, that most Israelis and Palestinians know the parameters of a final agreement and can live with them. In terms of Israel, first of all, we have to understand that Israel doesn't seem to be right now under pressure to resolve the conflict. In the years that have passed since the Second Intifada, Israel became a safer place. There isn't this sense of urgency that you need to solve the conflict in order to move into some kind of normal lifestyle in Israel. Israel does enjoy a normal lifestyle. There's also not much pressure on the international arena. We see this drive by the Americans, but Israelis are looking around to the region, and with all the upheaval in the Middle East, it seems, at least the Israeli interpretation of it, is that if there was this concept out there in the past that solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is key to understanding the Middle East, to gaining peace in the Middle East, now it seems clear that that won't be enough as such. And so Israelis don't feel great pressure to move forward with the peace process. Although when you look at polls, you see that most Israelis accept the notion of a two-state solution, understand that it includes giving up most of the West Bank. But on a practical level, they don't see any urgency of doing it right now when there's no pressure from inside or from outside to move ahead.
Quick follow-up to you, Nathan. On the other hand, some talk about the demographic issue where Palestinians are going to become a majority in these occupied territories. And then if a two-state solution isn't negotiated quickly, that this could be a major problem for Israel internationally. So in that regard, there does seem to be a time pressure.
I guess the only ticking clock here is the demographic clock in terms of how will the international public opinion view Israel if it's between the river and the sea, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. There's a majority of Arabs, but not all of them have voting rights, and therefore it's the Jewish minority that controls them. And of course, that could happen somewhere down the road. And that also is part of the concern that Israelis have of moving the whole discussion into the international arena, into the UN and other international stages, International Criminal Court, of course. So that is some kind of a concern for the Israelis, but it seems further down the road right now, and it doesn't really, since we have governments and voters that are more concerned about now and tomorrow morning, they're not really concerned about 10, 20, 30 years from now.
Back to you, Haith Al-Omari. What about public opinion in the Palestinian territories and the fact that, you know, a lot of Palestinians are talking about, well, let's just have a one-state solution, that it's becoming more and more difficult to even visualize the possibility of two states given the impasse?
Actually, what's interesting is that despite of the impasse and despite of all the negativity, the majority of the Palestinians still believe in a two-state solution, just like the Israelis. And this is an interesting mirror image that we have seen over the last two decades, at least. Yet the other part of the coin is the Palestinians, by the way, just like the Israelis, this is a mirror image. Most of the Palestinians who believe in a two-state solution believe that it cannot be done because of the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, you see people starting to lose faith in a two-state solution, but also people realize that despite all of the bluster about one state this and one state that, there is no solution but a two-state solution. And the real alternative to a two-state solution is the continuation of a conflict, maybe in a different form. So there is still, I think, a willingness to go for a two-state solution, but there is little hope that this will be achieved soon.
So back to you, Nathan Gutman. Let's assume, perhaps, in an optimistic way, that some kind of a diplomatic effort can overcome the current impasse. What about the fundamental lack of trust which seems to exist on both sides? Is anything being done on the grassroots level to build trust between Israelis and Palestinians?
There's hardly anything done. Of course, there are a few local programs, nonprofits working on the ground, Americans trying to help out. But in general, even though in the years after the 94 Oslo Agreement, there was this notion out there that one of the reasons that Oslo never actually picked up was because there wasn't this understanding on the ground, this building of trust between the two nations. And there were initial attempts, but frankly, nothing is really going on the ground now. There is also, you should keep in mind, with the separation wall and with the restrictions on the movement of Palestinians, there's very little encounter on a daily basis between Israelis and Palestinians. They share a very small piece of land, but they hardly see each other. And if there is any kind of encounter, it would usually be between a Palestinian family and an Israeli soldier in a roadblock. So there's definitely a lot more to be done in terms of building trust between the two nations.
And back to you, Haith Al-Omari, the same question, you know, in terms of this building trust and the sense of identifying one side with the other. Do you see any activities on the ground? Have we learned anything from Oslo in the intervening years? And again, of course, Israelis still continue to, and with some justification, criticize the Palestinian side for hate speech and for demonizing Israelis, delegitimizing Israel and so forth. Anything being done to counter that?
On that last point, actually, while, of course, unpleasant and negative speech continues, yet things are actually much better now than they were in the 90s. There were recently a study conducted by Yale professor with Palestinian and Israeli participants that shows that while the representation of the other in textbooks in both communities is negative, but it doesn't go up to the level of demonization. And so there have been some progress. But in general, I tend to agree with Natan. Between the two peoples, there is very little interaction. On the Palestinian side now, we see a lot of even resistance to any of these people-to-people steps yet. One thing that gives me hope at this moment is while the publics are not meeting, and they should meet, yet there is one sector that continues to cooperate in unprecedented ways, which is the security sector. The security cooperation between the Israelis and the Palestinians on the ground, because of the efforts of former Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, continues to be at excellent levels, which accounts for what Natan mentioned earlier, the calm in the security situation. And that continues to be one of the anchors that I look at, and I'm hopeful as I see things, and I think that that will prevent a descent to the worst kind of violence that we were experiencing in the 90s and beginning of the century.
All right, and as we conclude, and back to you one more time for a last word, Leith Al-Omari, do you see a way to break the impasse? What will it take besides enormous political will and coherence, which both sides seem to lack at this point, you know, to break this impasse?
Let me say two things. I've been doing this long enough to have seen quite a few of these crises. This is last-minute brinksmanship. What's interesting so far is that none of the three sides, not the Americans, not the Israelis, not the Palestinians, have come out and declared the negotiations dead. They actually, all of them, went out of their way to say that the negotiations are not dead yet. So I see efforts there. I see no interest by any of the three players for a collapse. Yet, sometimes things spin out of control. My own assessment is that we will see energetic efforts and we will see attempts to bridge this, and we might even have a success in this one.
All right. Well, and the last word to you, Natan Gutman, are you equally optimistic, or how do you see the talks going forward?
I wish I could be that optimistic. I think there is definitely a good chance that we'll overcome this current crisis, as Reitha said. We've seen this before. It can actually happen. Americans push a little harder. There's some international help. Both sides agree to return to the table and maybe improve their deal a little bit. But on the bigger question, can we reach a real agreement? For that, you need to assume that there's a political will on both sides. And right now, I'm not sure I see that. And with the lack of any kind of credible pressure from the United States or from the international community, I don't see either side actually taking the risks needed.
All right. Well, on that rather dubious note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of the program. I'd like to thank my guests, Gaith Al-Omari, Executive Director at the American Task Force on Palestine, and Natan Gutman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Jewish Daily Forward. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your unique insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.